This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 29th of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 260th edition of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Steve Bloomfield.
Coming up on today's programme, she was one of Nelson Mandela's closest confidants. We'll speak to Zelda LaGrange on her life by the side of one of the 20th century's most influential figures.
Also ahead... Here they are for one and all, the moments are about to call. Come on and sit down here with me, they're here for you on your TV, they are the moments. Tove Jansson, creator of the Moomins and some of Finland's most treasured cultural gems, would have been 100 years old this year. We'll meet those behind a new exhibition marking the centenary.
And before the end of the programme, we'll meet the filmmaker behind a new documentary short that assesses football's cultural heritage in the host nation for this year's World Cup, Brazil.
That and some music too, all to come right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Welcome to it, everybody. And Steve, how's this week been? What have you been doing? Have you been rolling up your sleeves, ticking things off the list?
I've been ticking a few things off the list, yes. I do have a list, always. But yeah, no, it's actually been... It's funny, June as a month for us here at Monocle, because whereas for everyone else the summer hasn't started, this is pretty much our summer. It's the downtime after the quality of life issue. We're doing the Mediterranean newspaper, which is... a little bit more relaxed.
It's sort of relaxed, isn't it?
And then it's all going to kick into gear once again when July rolls around. So, yeah, this is the downtime. It's been quite nice. There's been lots of lunchtimes, haven't there, outside?
There have been some sunny lunchtimes. There have been some trips away. And, of course, having the... I'm not going to mention the cricket, but I mentioned the World Cup and I mentioned Wimbledon being on the TV. It really feels like it's summer, right? It's something in the air. Not just pollen.
No. Although there is certainly that the weather does help. Let's be honest.
It's pretty
the
decent.
Fact that it has been here in London in the early 20s is lots of. I'll wear a t-shirt today.
What do you think the temperature is in Studio One this afternoon?
You know what? It's actually just right.
I put it on heat mode.
Is it on heat mode?
I'm getting sacked for that probably, but there we go.
Yeah, I thought that was bad.
It out.
But it's also not too hot. This is very much a Goldilocks studio. It's either too hot or too cold.
I'm kind of trying to get into the vibe. I think normally, in terms of our guests that are coming up on the show, this is more like the kind of place that Tove Jansson would be comfortable in. It's more Finnish.
It is.
But today
not
I'm turning the
Brazilian.
Heat up because, you know, we've got a bit of South Africa and a bit of Brazil. Why not? Let's welcome our guests into a place in which they will feel comfortable. That's what I thought. It's not just me being selfish and wanting to wear a t-shirt in the studio like a madman.
No. Not selfish in any way whatsoever. I'm sure they'll appreciate that. I think that probably shouldn't be the first line of questioning to them. Do you like what we've done to make people feel up with an easy question?
Thanks for writing a book about Nelson Mandela. What do you think of the temperature in here? It's quite nice, isn't it?
It will throw them. That's true. That's certainly true.
It'll throw them. Yeah, exactly. The home of the easy question. the overhead lob from the 356th ranked player in the world.
Basically, all the questions should be weather related.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's make it the most British radio show of all time. And also maybe ask people how they got here. Do you know what I mean? Did you come down the A3? People love talking about that, don't they?
They do.
Directions.
We can also talk to them about how they like their tea.
It's going well already, isn't it?
Yeah.
What do you think we should do? Should we have the news look ahead?
We should. The slight worry I have about it is that Tom Edwards isn't here this week.
Right.
I mean, I'm just worried now.
You are worried?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Alid John is going to step into his shoes. Mm. I don't know whether exactly his shoes.
Well, sort of size, let us hope not for Alid's sake.
I'm guessing a size 9 Nike Air Max. but here he is. He doesn't have his own theme tune, unfortunately, but here he is. Alid John will be up next with the news look ahead. And here he is, as discussed, sans theme tune, but nonetheless with some nice rustly bits of paper with some highlighted points, some bullet bits, some la-la-la. La-la-la.
I thought it was a crystal ball he was supposed to have.
Oh, yeah, crystal ball, yeah. That's just those new water jugs.
When am I going to get a jingle? I've done it a few times.
You're right.
You promised me one last time, Rob.
Can we have maybe the
title track from Catatonia's International Velvet, the chorus of which is, "Every morning I wake up and I thank the Lord I'm Welsh."
Do you want me to
This is a co-production. Thomas Lewis is producing the show. You're doing the news look ahead. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I feel like we should be all doing an arm wrestle.
Tom, you come in and do the harmonies.
Right, what's on the menu?
Some appetising treats, some other fairly bleak stories. But we'll start with the bleak and move on to the sweet.
Okay, why not? Yeah.
So this is one of those stories which seems to just keep on bubbling along, not so much in the limelight at the moment, given what's happening in Iraq. But the deadline for the elimination of all of the chemical weapon materials from Syria passes tomorrow on the 30th of June. That deadline for the actual elimination is going to be overshot by some months because they've actually only just finished taking out what they have declared as their actual chemical stockpile. 8% was reportedly the remaining figure from what was left after all of the evacuated materials over the last year.
So this is all the chemical weapons that after the attacks last year that the OPCW said, look, this is what you've got, this is what you've got hand over.
This is the declared materials that the government has declared. And interestingly, there's a point which you should definitely consider that chlorine, many Western governments still think chlorine is being used by the Assad regime as a chemical weapon. And there have been reports of that and the effects of it being used, which obviously breaches international law. The problem being is that chlorine as a chemical is a very commonly used chemical. And so that in itself is not a weapon. So they don't have to declare that they've got chlorine, but when it gets turned into a weapon, then that breaches international law and used as a weapon, obviously.
And this is obviously, as you say, this is sort of taken backstage, you know, to what else is happening, especially in that part of the world. How murky is this? I mean, it seems it's a tough thing almost to sell as a news story, isn't it? Because it's so complicated, it seems.
Well, it's not just murky, as Steve will know. It's not just murky because of the actors and what's being used. It's murky because what is going on in Iraq is relevant because the ISIS or the ISIL, depending on how you want to term them, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria or the Levant, many of those fighters are, as you'll see in the news, battle-hardened, as they call it, from time in Syria. And so suddenly it muddies the waters where they're doing such atrocious things in Iraq. There is no good or bad situation in Syria at the moment. The Assad regime is being seen as a helpful hand in the Iraq situation because they're bombing Sunni Islamist militant targets, and the Maliki administration there, they're happy about it. So it is all very murky. The chemical weapons has taken a backseat, rightly so perhaps, but
and
it's
also
something that
if
will
you're
be bumping
along. If you're a Syrian citizen at risk, then frankly, whether it's a chemical weapon or whether it's a barrel bomb or it's merely shrapnel, it's
still
all
going to affect your life. Yep. One interesting point to bear in mind, though, is the logistics operation for taking these chemical weapons out. It is actually very fascinating. It's a sort of an international collaborative effort. So you've got a Danish freighter which has been picking up the materials from Syria. That's called the Arc Futura. That's now sailing to the Italian port of Gioteldo for a rendezvous with an American vessel, the MV Cape Ray, which itself, I really like this point, is a converted car ferry.
All right.
648 foot converted car ferry.
Used to be shipping around Hondas, now being used for chemical weapons.
Mustard gas, yeah. There we are. It has been waiting at Spanish port of Rota for 4 months for the extradition of the chemical weapons from Syria to be completed. Yeah, it's an incredibly dangerous, difficult procedure, which is still going to be taking place. As I said, the deadline for the actual elimination of the chemical weapons, which was supposed to be tomorrow, is going to be overshot by some months. But the declared materials have actually been taken out of the country, as far as we know.
Okay, what's next?
Cool. Staying in the Middle East, just quickly, a brief point, because I think we could probably talk all day and none of us be any the wiser about it. Iraq's parliament is to hold a session starting the process of forming a new government. This is the kind of a sop to the international community who have been calling for Maliki's administration to reflect the diversity of Iraq, so they might be able to make some steps toward, what can I call
it? Good use of the word might. Yes.
Resolving some of the tensions there. Let's
put it. Well, that's something that we'll keep an eye on, I'm sure, in the live shows next week. What else do you have for us?
British story, the sentencing of former News of the World editor Andy Coulson. I'll be looking forward to that.
Is that happening this week?
Yeah, the sentencing sentence will be on the 4th of July.
The irony of it being Independence Day. Lack
and,
of,
and
maybe.
He will lose it, yes. That'll be interesting to watch, see how many years he gets.
I don't know what the precedent is for years with hacking of phones, because obviously he hasn't been successfully convicted on the unlawful payments to public officials charge.
No, although he is still going to have an issue of whether he purged himself in Scotland, which perjury is a very serious crime.
Does that count in England, though? Doesn't it?
Yeah, he'll have to. I think it's going to be. There'll be a separate trial for that
in Scotland,
which then means you go to a Scottish jail if found guilty.
So that'd be nice.
Good luck.
And a couple of light ones quickly, perhaps. Rob, you like this one? Christie's auctioning of Tracy Emin's My Bed, the 1998 artwork of her unmade bed.
And I interviewed her last week about this, so it's going to be on tomorrow's Culture Show, in fact.
So she never sold it, then?
Well, selling it through Christie's. But it's an interesting thing. I mean, it's one of those things. It caused such a sensation. It was in that sensation show. Big splash. It was kind of one of the works of art, along with her stuff, that every cab driver had an opinion on for the first time ever. I thought it was a very healthy thing. I wonder how well it stood the test of time. Not just, I mean, physically, obviously. it's a little bit scruffy. but as an artwork, I think it's an interesting thing. It seems very emblematic of that time. But personally, I think that it's a piece of work that opened up a lot of, especially female artists, to be very personal and do the kind of thing that male artists have been doing for hundreds of years. So I've always thought it was a wonderful piece, and it sort of still is. But it's strange seeing it again, you know, and again, auctioning something like that. It's so not a painting. You know, it's so big and unwieldy and strange. Clearly, it'll end up probably in a private collection, but hopefully not in a vault, hopefully on public display.
You'd hope that so, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a little bit like Back to the 90s, though.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously it is Back to the 90s, because it was 98. It feels like we should be talking about Noel Gallagher as well.
It does. We can talk about him as well if you
we
want.
We can. Yeah, later in the show.
The next guest.
And on the 5th of July, the Tour de France kicks off in Yorkshire. So Chris Froome won it last year for Britain. Success.
Do they need a map? Do we need a compass? I mean, what?
You know, it often starts in different countries.
Yeah,
starting in Leeds. Stop being silly, Rob.
Stop being silly. Nice.
That's
okay.
That's all I got. That's all I got for you guys.
Alec, John, thank you very much for your news. Look ahead. Thank you very much indeed.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
London is New York is Tokyo. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
When Nelson Mandela was laid to rest at the end of last year, leaders from around the world descended on South Africa to join the nation in mourning its most revered son. But few of those paying tributes to Madiba at the memorial services shared as long-standing and as intimate a relationship with South Africa's former president as our next guest.
Zelda LaGrange joined the staff at South Africa's presidential offices as a senior typist. 5 years later, she was appointed as one of President Mandela's private secretaries, and in 1999, Mandela himself requested that she stay in his employ in the years following his retirement from political life. And Zelda LaGrange, author of the new book, Good Morning, Mr. Mandela, joins us now in the studio. Zelda, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you. Great being here. Thank you very much.
Let's start with when you began working in the president's office, because that was for a different president at a different time, wasn't it?
No, well, I actually started my career at the Department of State Expenditure under a different president, but not directly linked to President de Klerk at the time. And then in 1994, after the first democratic elections, I simply applied for a job in the presidency, working for the president's private secretary. So not even for him directly. It was just a logistical problem I was trying to resolve, getting a job closer to my parents' home.
And when you were working there at the start, this was obviously South Africa was going through enormous transition with its first democratically elected black president. As a young white woman working in that office, what was the experience like for you?
You know, at first, I mean, you're scared because this is the government and the people you were brought up to fear. So I was hesitant, but I was always very conscious of the fact that if I didn't like it there, if I, you know, anyone was treated me with disrespect or was nasty to me, I would leave. A job is a job. But interestingly, the president called all the staff from the old presidency into his office just after he took over power. And he said to people, look, you are free to leave, but I would like you to stay and to transfer your skill to the new incoming government and to help us to rebuild this country if you want to do that. But it's your choice. I wouldn't force you to leave, but I also wouldn't force you to stay. So he allayed fears, you know, and throughout, he was such a strategist that he always took these brilliant decisions, genius decisions in a way, small things that ended up being the big things and getting people on his side, winning people over one at a time almost.
There's a lot of buzz. around the book, which is one of the reasons why you're a bit hoarse on our show, because I know you've been doing a lot of talking this week. So it's like you've created a lot of buzz about it.
You should talk and I should listen now.
Yeah, my questions are notoriously long, Zelda. But there's been a lot of buzz about the book. Part of that has been about your sort of transformation from being a white South African and growing up in apartheid and being for it, you know, as a youngster. That's clearly an interesting journey to go on, and it makes interesting reading. Can you distill that for us briefly, to, you know, kind of what it was like growing up, what the language was like, and how that changed, and how it bore itself out in that job and in your relationship with
Mandela? Yes, you know what, the reason for me writing this book, first of all, was when I started off, it was really just to record my memory because I was forgetting stuff. And then when it turned into a book, I realized, but wait, there's a journey here. There's a metamorphosis here that I need to record and that I need to tell the world. If you asked me at the age of 23, are you a racist? I would have said, no, of course not. No. Now, having gone through the change and reading my own book, I realize, look, you were a racist. Admit it. It's one of the most important things that Madiba taught me, is that don't deny your past. You don't have it to allow it to determine your future, but live with it and be proud of what you are and commit to a future. So, I mean, growing up in South Africa, we lived apartheid. You know, we all had white families, all had a black living person that brought up the children, a surrogate mother almost. We were close to that person. She protected me against my brother, for instance, his bullying. But other than that, you know, she lived in a separate room. She was not allowed to use our cutlery. She was not allowed to sit on our couches. Not that my parents ever told her, but she also lived apartheid by accepting that as the norm. And if you look at South Africa today and how people have changed, we have a very interesting racial debate going on in South Africa right now. And now people, after reading this book, they say to me, I don't know if it's the truth, but they say to me they can relate to things, they can express themselves, because once someone admits, look, we were all racist, just admit it and move on. Now people are coming out and people are saying, but yes, let's change our future.
Were there any individual moments when you were working for Nelson Mandela where you realized that your own views were changing, or that things that you had assumed were solid were actually wrong?
Yes, you know what, I was such an opinionated person at 23. If you asked me about euthanasia, I would have an opinion that would shock you. If you asked me about racism, I would be very strongly opinionated about, yes, it's my right. You know, now I've learned to kind of allow people to believe what they want. You are responsible only for yourself. And that's because of an influence from both Madiba and his wife, Mrs. Mashala, in my life. And if I look at the person, the 23-year-old that walked into that office, I don't recognize that person, to be quite honest. That's how different things are for me now, and how different I see the world. I can think about things properly, even in a political situation, in dealing with South Africa's challenges. I understand things better, and people sometimes criticize me and say I'm pro-government, and I'm not. I just know the challenges to be in government. I've seen the poverty in South Africa. I've seen the extent of the challenges in South Africa, so I can think differently.
I mean, I wanted to, obviously, your book, take the backdrop to your book. And much of the detail of the book is obviously the momentous history that you lived through. But also a lot of it is obviously the intimate details of your dealings with Mandela. Did you feel that he trusted you more because he knew where you'd kind of come from? That you were almost a convert? You know what
you
I mean?
I don't think you're far from wrong. He probably also saw that I was naive, I was gullible, I was young. He could mold me into what he wanted me to be for him, you know, to step into the shoes of supporting him. He recognized my dedication and my loyalty. I'm by nature, that's who I am. My parents are like that. We are a bit obsessive compulsive, all of us. So it worked for the job. And he could influence me. And he really went through a lot of trouble, and he had so much patience trying to explain my own history to me, and he could recite the Afrikaner history better than I could. So I've learned so much about my own people from him. You know, our most famous poets in South Africa, some of them Afrikaans, Langenhoven and Leipold, it's not names that I expect you to remember, but those people, he could quote them. I couldn't, as an Afrikaner, and they are my people. So he really did, he went through great detail trying to win me over as well. And if a person like Nelson Mandela does that, he almost charmed me into, you know, loving him really, and being dedicated and so loyal to him. So yeah, it was easy for me to change.
You mentioned your parents and growing up in an Afrikaner household during apartheid and supporting that system. How did they react to, first of all, you going to work for Nelson Mandela when he became president? And then as you made your own transformation over the years, how did they deal with that?
It definitely changed them and their friends and their friends. So it had a ripple effect on our society and our circle of people. At first, it was difficult because some people ostracized my parents after they saw me serving tea to a black man. It was really as simple as that. They said, we can't be friends with people if they serve tea to black men. After a while, after he wore the rugby jersey in 1995, of course, you know, all people loved Nelson Mandela. And then those same people asked me to have books signed for them, which I happily then organized. So that was really the transformation in our own society as well. And interestingly, my father, who considered this man a terrorist, was the first person I spoke to after Madiba's death on the 5th of December. So the next morning I spoke to my dad, and my dad was sobbing. They learned to appreciate this man so much. He changed
them
so much. Yes, they actually went and had lunch with him on a few occasions. Not that I arranged, but may I just say, I didn't push my family in. He insisted on seeing them. And my dad also planted trees for him at his farm in Kunu, where the burial was held. And I mean, we've got a great sense of humor in our family. So while my dad was busy planting these trees, I took a picture and I said to him, hey, look at this, times have changed now. You're working in a black man's garden. So, you know, life has just changed completely for all of us. And the way they relate to people, you know, they're an older generation. It was going to be more difficult for them to change. But just how they relate to people in general, it's a complete turnaround.
And the photographs in the book, Zelda, there's obviously lots of pictures of you with Nelson Mandela. Was there any sense you felt that you might be a bit of a poster child? Like, if she can do it, the country can do it. They can make the mental change. You're a blonde South African. I wonder whether there were perhaps photo opportunities that might have been serendipitous or planned.
No, not really. You know what? People now say that, and I enjoy people being frank about it, because they say, how do you feel about the fact that he may have used you as a token white? And you know what? If you are pinned as the token white in Nelson Mandela's story, why not?
Yeah.
I was just going to be honored to take up that position. And he introduced me to people like the Emperor of Japan as, she's a Boeremeisie, she's a real Afrikaner. And I could see the Emperor didn't understand a word he was saying. But that is who I represented. And I'm not going to deny that I'm an Afrikaner, so I happily obliged.
The way that most Afrikaners now see Nelson Mandela has obviously changed dramatically. But do you think that the way that many Afrikaners view black people generally in South Africa has changed to the same extent?
That's a great question to ask, really, because there's still a lot of resistance in South Africa. People have not been privy to the exposure that I've been privy to. And it's exactly with this book, I'm trying to share those experiences, to say to people, we are not a superior race merely because of the color of our skin. You know, open your world, travel, get an understanding of the world much earlier. And even young people, ask questions. Because if I did that, my life would have been much different and change would have been easier. But there is still a lot of resistance in South Africa. And I'm hoping to touch other people's lives by telling them who this man really was.
Well, Zelda, thank you so much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. You heard the voice of Zelda LaGrange, author of Good Morning, Mr. Mandela. Thank you. Time for some music now. And as we'll be heading to the World Cup a little later in the programme to look at football's cultural legacy in the host nation, let's hear one of our World Cup alternative national anthems. Germany's official national anthem, Deutschlandian, set to the score of Joseph Haydn's Ode to Joy, is arguably one of the most recognisable national songs in the world.
But as Johann Laux explains now, it's a pop song from 1960 that perhaps sums up the German national character today.
Weine nicht, wenn der Regen fällt, dam, 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 dam. Es gibt einen, der zu dir hält, dam, 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 dam.
Well, it's Graffi Deutsch's Marmor, Stein und Eisenbricht, and it's a German Schlager. It just had to be a Schlager. It's not really an anthem as such. It's not a football anthem, and it's not part of German history, but actually, every German knows the lyrics. And it's a mystery to me, I don't know why, but it's this Schlager genre. It's something like the French have their chansons, so we Germans, we have a Schlager. It's sometimes brilliant, but very often horrible. And it's the only popular music genre that constantly sold songs which were sung in German, actually. The soundtrack to our reunification was actually in English. So it was David Hasselhoff singing I've Been Looking for Freedom, but no song in German. Legend has it that Graffi Deutscher, who sings the song, went as a 19-year-old into the office of his record company humming Dum Dum, Dum Dum. Dum Dum, Dum Dum. And so the person who would compose the music asked him, Graffi, what's next? And he said, well, you'll make that up. I don't know. The language of the song is very, very interesting because Dum 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 obviously has no meaning, and the chorus Marmorstein und Eisenbricht is grammatically incorrect. So in Bavaria, which is a substate in Germany, the song was actually banned for wrong grammar. This is German history in the 1960s. Weine nicht, wenn der Regen fällt. Dum 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 Dum. Es gibt einen, der zu dir hält. Dum Dum. It's a song about loyalty and fidelity and love. So it says, whatever solid materials like marble, stone or iron, whatever may happen to them, they might break, they might bend. Love, or our love, Drafi's love, will never run out. Drafi's love is forever. I would say that loyalty as such is part of the German mindset. We are very loyal people, so if you're an aging rock star and you want to go on tour and you want to sell out a stadium, you should actually come to Germany. I think David Hasselhoff, for example, he could still have an audience of 20,000 people. No problem, we are very loyal. So it's part of a national myth, I would say. The song is from the 1960s and it's sung in German, and now in 2014 it is less weird to listen to a song in German than it was maybe in the year 2000. And it has to do with the World Cup, it has to do with that Germany in the 90s or 80s secretly changed a bit. It became a bit, at least in the younger generations, more open. But there was no chance to show to the other nations. So the World Cup was actually the moment where we could show the rest of the world that we're actually not that bad as our past is, and that we welcome other cultures.
And Germany! Extraordinary score through Philipp Lahm with only 5 minutes played. What a start to the 2006 FIFA World Cup.
It's a fun thing in German popular music. It's a certain form of Dada or Dadaism that continues. It's a tradition to be very minimal, and this is why I like it. But honestly, I wouldn't sing it out loud in public.
Johann Laux there on the music of Graffi Deutscher, Germany's alternative national anthem. And you can hear more of the World Cup's alternative national songs throughout the tournament in Brazil here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll be celebrating the centenary of the Finnish writer Tove Jansson. Do stay with us.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programmes to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Insta paper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The menu isn't just about food or drinks, it's about the people with innovative ideas, the ones who savor traditions, and the ones who are willing to go further than most in search of the most delicious ingredients. Whether it's an author who's discovered true adventure through food, or a master bartender traveling the world in search of new and exciting flavors, the menu uncovers the tastiest tales from around the globe.
We are finally walking to the simple way of eating, being, but I think it's a universal trend, this kind of simplicity.
As well as going behind the scenes with top chefs such as René Redzepi and Massimo Bottura, we find out the latest in restaurant design, the creative culinary experiences keeping city dwellers' taste buds tingling, and what Japanese clubbing culture and noodles have in common. Join me, Markus Hipp, before the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Steve Bloomfield.
Here they are for one and all. The moments are about to call. Come on and sit down here with me. They're here for you on your TV. They are the moments.
Does that sound familiar? Of course it does, because we used it in the introduction as well. The animated interpretation of the Moomins, of course. Well, Tove Jansson, who created the Moomins, has long been regarded as one of Finland's most celebrated artists, creating stories that have become modern fairy tales.
She was born 100 years ago this year, and to mark that centenary, an exhibition of photographs here in London is peeling back Jansson's creations to reveal something of the artist herself. And Anna Meyer Grant, co-curator of the exhibition Tales from the Nordic Archipelago, joins us in the studio now. Anna Meyer, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much.
Now, the Moomins is obviously her most famous creation, but before we delve into that, she was so much more than what's become known as just a kid's cartoon, wasn't she?
Absolutely. I mean, she had the most multifaceted artistic career. She was an author, a visual artist, whose career spanned over 70 years. So, and she was a political character, she was openly gay, she was very pioneering in many ways.
And this must be kind of balm to a curator to have such a great backstory to tell. And you've got the Moomins, you've got the famous, you've got the icon, you've got the brand that the Moomins became, and then you've got all this sort of meat to kind of get your teeth into. Where on earth do you start with it? Do you do it chronologically, thematically? Where did you start going through the archives?
We kind of wanted to zoom into her life at the archipelago and how that impacted her artistic practice. They lived in an island, which is basically a rock. They had no plumbing, no running water, no electricity, obviously, and even the drinking water was brought from the mainland. A lot of her work was created there, and she had a very sort of, a lot of it has a very strong connection. Her books are about living with nature, seasons, respect and humility with nature, and that was kind of where we started building up the photography pieces.
And a lot of her work is very much based on her own life, so whether that's, you know, her early cartoons that were drawn during the Second World War, which underlying it all, there was that feeling of a sense of fear and not knowing what the next day would bring. Then also her own relationships as well were borne out in some of those cartoons as well, weren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, I think what's interesting about the Moomins is that they sort of obviously written for children, but there's so much deeper, more philosophical kind of stories there about complex characters, you know, good people being bad, bad people being good, darkness, light, melancholy, happiness, adventure. So there's a lot of dimension there to delve into.
And the archipelago itself, I mean, do you think this, I mean, it's obviously part of the Finnish landscape.
Yeah.
How much did that affect her work, the physicality of the place in which she made her art?
I think her literature, for example, the fact that they were completely living on a, you know, had to be in the terms of nature. And they created a lot of the Moomin characters actually physically built from rocks and, yeah. and various bits and pieces they found in the island. They created the work there. So, yeah, it was integral part of who she was and how her work came out. The colours in her Moomin illustrations that are celebrated are very much the kind of natural colours that come from that landscape.
And how is she, you know, 100 years on from her birth, how is she celebrated or thought of in Finland?
There's a massive exhibition of her work at the Ateneum Museum in Helsinki. I think, you know, her relevance today is just as strong as it was 50, you know, years ago. I think that now there's a kind of an understanding that she was so experimental as an artist. I mean, her work from going from, it's a massive, massive body of work in the Ateneum Museum, how different it was. She was completely, she had no self-consciousness about her work as an artist. She would go from style to style and experiment and kind of, you know, do things that most artists wouldn't really do.
It's interesting. Rob and I were, before we came on air, looking at some of her work because it's, as you say, there are so many different styles and some of it is so different from from the Moomins. From
what is beautiful, like oil on canvas portraiture, which you just wouldn't put.
Whereas the Moomins is often seen as quite a simplistic sort of drawing that actually even a child can probably do themselves.
Yeah, there were frescoes, massive frescoes that a lot of people don't even know about. So this is the 100th anniversary has been a great opportunity to celebrate that and show her work and what it was. She wasn't just a Moomin mama, she was so much more. Also her adult literature, I'd like that to sort of come forward. There's the summer book and the winter book are the most beautiful, elegant pieces of writing that there, you know, are.
I wanted to go back to the elephant in the room, or the whatever it is, the Moomin in the room. Sort of feels like sort of breathing down my neck, you know. And that is the Moomins. And I wonder whether, I mean, she didn't sell up. I mean, they had to sort of create, her and her brother, I think, didn't they, sort of created the brand that the Moomins became, or to protect the brand, as it were, to protect the artist's copyright and things. She turned down offers from Disney, etc., to sell it. Do you think that's a sort of important part of the purity, maybe, of what the Moomins became, despite the fact that awful soundtrack that we heard in the introduction to Anamaya? Yeah. It had a purity about it that lots of things kind of don't have, no matter their sort of supposed innocence.
I think, yes. I mean, it's still a family company, family firm, run by her granddaughter now, Sofia Jansson. So, definitely. And I think she had this motto, love and work. You know, it was all about, she had to believe in what she did, in everything. She was, on one hand, this celebrated author and artist and Moomin creator, but she really loved being in an island, you know, where she had nothing. So there was a simplicity and honesty about her life, and she could have never, ever sold out and done things that she didn't believe in. And she knew that if she would have given the Moomins to Disney, she would no longer have any control or connection to the original characters.
And also just seeing through the prism of this extra material that you've got in the show, all this huge, rich swathe of stuff that's non-Moomin related. Mm. Do you think that through that you can tell that maybe she was trapped by being the creator of the Moomin somehow as an artist?
I think there's an interesting book called The True Receiver, where there's a character who resembles her a lot she wants to be an all-around artist, but she draws these bunnies that make her famous, and then she becomes kind of almost a prisoner of the bunny world, which very much, I think, is her. Yes, I mean, we sort of decided to look at her life through photographs that are very intimate, taken by her brother Per-Olof Jonsson and Sege Hagström. So it's more of a look into who she was and how she lived their life. And the Moomins are taking a little bit of a backseat. We have some illustrated books and first editions there on show as well. But it's mainly a story of her life through the photography.
When her career was first taking off in the 40s and 50s and then obviously a little bit later, how much did her sexuality matter in Finland?
I mean, it was one of those things that wasn't really talked about very much. I find it interesting how accepting people were of her. I think
it wasn't talked about in the sense that, well, we'll just ignore that. But it didn't really matter at all.
I don't think it was really talked about, but it was also, it didn't matter to a point that no one would kind of expose her or make her life more difficult. She came from an artistic family. Her father was a sculptor and her mother was a visual artist as well. So she lived in a world that kind of had its own rules a little bit, a very sort of bohemian place. So in a way, that probably helped. But even, I mean, she went to the ball, the president's ball with her female partner, and that was accepted.
Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing the show. It opens on the 15th of July at the ICA, right? And it's amazing. And also, she took such a good picture. She was just such a striking woman. Mm. I like the pictures just of her. Yeah. You could look at the whole show just the pictures of her. She had such a good look, which sounds like an exceptionally shallow thing to say about a great artist. But you know what I mean? It's that helps with the show.
No, a lot of like fashion magazines have picked up on that and the aesthetic of it and her kind of elegance and colours. And
I like that we can look that good living on a desert island.
Yeah, right. I know.
There's hope for us.
Finland's Robinson Crusoe. Anna-Maja Grant, co-curator of the show Tales from the Nordic Archipelago on at London's ICA from the 15th of July. Thank you so much for coming in.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Robert Bound. Up next, we'll turn our attention to the World Cup and take a look at football's cultural heritage in Brazil. Stay with us.
The numbers have been crunched, the editors have deliberated, and now we can unveil who came top in our 2014 survey of the best cities to call home. You'll discover the risers and fallers and a few new entries in our July-August summer double issue. It also includes a 28-page travel guide to South Tyrol, the Italian Alpine province, where you're as likely to hear the locals speaking German and where great hotels, bars and restaurants fill every cute town. And there's more.
In the design section, we head to Auckland to see how a recently rejuvenated works depot in the middle of the city has provided a new home for the city's creative class. And then from bridges in Berlin to baths in Budapest, we discover some of the world's most charming gathering points and also pick out 10 of the best urban details from knobs in Valencia to manhole covers in Japan.
In the edit section, we head to a venerable old market in Porto. Not only has the Mercado de Bilbao put food on the city's tables for the past century, its ongoing importance goes to show that bigger and shinier don't always mean better. We also explore three inner city enclaves offering an agreeable quality of life from Taipei to London and Santiago.
Monocle's July-August double issue is on newsstands around the world now, or get yourself a subscription at monocle.com.
Art as a tool to fix our lives? Alain de Botton believes it is. Monocle Films meets the philosopher in the Rijks Museum in Amsterdam, where visitors are introduced to this new therapeutic look at art.
It's not therapy in the sense of, you know, three times a week on a couch. It's therapeutic in the very loose sense of the word. Sometimes in our own life, we're like up against our problems, we feel a bit claustrophobic. So a picture of a wide open view can for a moment just open our minds and open ourselves to better horizons.
Art is therapy. Now playing in the film section on monocle.com.
Well, the chips are falling at the World Cup in Brazil. We know now which of the 16 nations taking part will go through to the next round of the contest and which are packing their bags and heading home. And the World Cup hosts, Brazil, are among the conquering heroes marching ever closer to football's most treasured trophy. And you don't need either of us to tell you that. For Brazil, football is woven into most corners of the national psyche.
A new documentary short, Penta Campeão, looks at football's cultural legacy in Brazil and explains the country's preoccupation with a beautiful game. And one of the film's producers, Charlie Inman, joins us in the studio now. Charlie, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much.
Now, football and Brazil obviously go hand in hand. We all know this. With Penta Campeão, which, well, first of all, perhaps you can explain what that means, where that comes from. But what is it in particular about football and Brazil that you were trying to explore in this film?
We sort of wanted to look at how massively obsessed they are with it and how, in a way, they define their sort of nation through the World Cup wins, the football that they play. So they're pretty much the only country that has names for each of their wins. And Penta is the fifth one. So they've won five so far. This year they're going for Hexa, which will be sixth. And we wanted to just kind of look at how Brazilians relate everything to their World Cup wins. So we went over to Sao Paulo and Rio and chatted to a whole load of people who were there at the time. So we found some super old people. And
yeah, some nice cast of characters. We had a whiz through the film. I love the bit at the beginning where some guy sitting in a bar in São Paulo, Rio, wherever it is, and he's kind of going, well, in England, you know, in the pub, you have pictures of Wellington and Churchill in your bars, you know, whereas here it's Pelé and it's, you know, Galincha and all these people. And that's quite a good analogy, I thought, to be made right at the beginning of the film, that, you know, we have the wars and they have the football, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, they've only had one war and it was pretty rubbish against the Paraguayans. They massacred a load of people.
Non-classic.
Yeah, it was not a classic.
It wasn't a classic war. No.
So, yeah, but they're pretty good at football. And it's kind of, I think the first almost win they had really kicked it off for them. You know, the fact that they had the World Cup, they were this crappy little country that no one had really heard of. They felt like
This was back basically. In 1950.
This was back in the 50s. They didn't sort of have a massive amount of national pride at the time. And for them to get to the final in their own country and get beaten, it was like a national disaster. It was the worst thing that ever happened.
Yeah, like it's a sort of human tragedy.
Exactly.
Natural, where people,
exactly.
You know, more than a war, maybe. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, it then was so important when they won it and gave them a sense of national pride. And I guess they kind of impressed the world. The world looks at the way that they play football and they think, ah, yeah, Brazilians are cool. That's kind of important to Brazilians to be cool. So the fact that it makes the world think they're cool really works for them.
Yeah, nice.
And aside from football, obviously Brazil has, in terms of other great exports to the world, they have music. And the other film that you've just finished as well is looking at some music in Brazil with Giles Peterson.
Yeah, we've just spent, I think it was about 6 weeks in all in Brazil with Giles Peterson, who went out there to make an album, which was amazing. That was, you know, the kind of opportunity that doesn't come up that often, to go and hang out with your childhood hero in your favourite place.
It's a tough job, isn't it? Yeah.
It's rubbish, honestly, quite frankly. I don't know why I bother.
And how did that work? Because the football film, the Pentacampeão, that's kind of done. You take people, football fans of all ages, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, we did.
How's the music film work?
They're all blags, essentially, to a greater or lesser extent. The music film, we found out that Giles Peterson was making an album over there, and we were talking to his label about some licensing stuff and said to them, is anybody filming this? Wouldn't it be a shame if we didn't film this initial foray off to Brazil and then some magical deal came together and we ended up being able to make a film? So how about we pay for our tickets and I'll go and stay with a friend of mine over there and we see how it works.
It mysteriously fell into place.
It all worked really nicely in the end.
And it's an interesting thing. I mean, we talked about football, we talked about music. These are two of the kind of pillars of Brazilian culture. Mm-hmm. There's an interesting thing going on in Brazil right now where they are very consciously trying to brand themselves against these two things, despite if they win the World Cup in a couple of weeks' time. Mm-hmm. There's still that thing where they don't want to be samba, football, beaches and bums. You know, they want to be, you know, they're obviously an important economy, et cetera, et cetera. They're kind of trying to change that. Do you feel, having spent quite a bit of time there recently, that that is a top-down branding thing? Or do you think that the people in the street basically like dancing and football?
Yeah, I think they're going to have a tough time convincing anybody that that's not what they're about. Because really, if you spend 10 minutes over there, you realise that actually it's all about football and music and the sort of joie de vivre of the people in the street. They'll turn anything into a big party as soon as there's music involved. And you see it far more than you do anywhere else in the world. Maybe Cuba rivals it in terms of just spontaneous street joyousness.
Was there anything in the making of these two films that surprised you about Brazil, something that you hadn't quite realised before you went?
Definitely. I mean, I've seen the changes recently have been enormous and massive, mind-boggling changes. But to realise quite how hardcore some of the favelas that aren't pacified yet have become since the pacification was, that flipped me out. I mean, there were certain places that we were like, no way are we taking Giles Peterson in there. It was like, if you imagine a farmer's market, it was like that, but with drugs, with kids with guns in the street, they've got boxes.
What sort of farmer's markets are you going to?
It was staggering. I had no idea. I mean, I'd been into favelas before, but since the pacification, they've kicked all the gangsters out of the nice favelas and they've all moved into the dodgy favelas, and those are just crazy. I mean, like the beginning of Star Wars. It's like a lawless world of kids with guns on the streets, drugs everywhere, police every now and then coming in with tanks. It's gun battles the whole
time.
Yeah.
Well, I think when I've been there, I've seen that sort of stuff. The gunships flying overhead is always a bit. It's always like when you have to sort of check your back pocket for your wallet and get out of there slightly.
So, yeah, that was surprising.
Do you feel that having made these two films, and these are obviously two ways potentially out of poverty, certainly they're kind of the cultural icons of football and music, obviously, you know, can pull you up by your bootstraps. Do you feel that's a way that people are being able to be pulled out of the slums?
Yeah. I mean, it's always a dodgy thing, isn't it, to sort of think, okay, right, poor black people, music and sport is not, it's not ideal that that's, you know, they're not thinking, wicked, let's educate these people, or, hey, let's get communities together. People are on the same kind of sport and music tip. But, you know, having said that, a lot's being done through those things to raise the you know, there's people like a guy called Luke runs a thing called Luta Pela Paz in the middle of the most hardcore favela, where he gets the kids doing boxing and taekwondo and things like that. And that's been a huge success. He's, you know, he's created heroes, and that's what they need in the area. He's created heroes who aren't drug dealers. And, you know, the same in music. So in places where people need someone to look up to, I think perhaps, you know, it's stereotypical, but if you can do it by making people from that area popular as a musician or popular as a sportsman, gives them someone else to idolise.
Nice. Well, Charlie Inman, it's a tough job, but someone's got to do it. Co-director and producer of Pentacampeão. What's the music film called with Charles Peter?
It's called Brazil Bam Bam Bam, The Story of Sonzeira.
Nice. There it is. Charlie Inman, thank you very much for your time on the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much.
So there we are, Rob.
There we have it, Stevie B.
I loved the chat about Tove Jansson.
Yeah,
mainly because
really
I can now say Tove Jansson.
And Amaya Grant. What a nice lady.
She was great. I would definitely be going along to the ICA to see that.
Yeah, it's cool. She had almost as good a look as Tove Jansson herself.
She did, actually.
The high
yes.
cheekbones of the Finn.
Yes.
I have to say, Charlie Inman, an amusing character. He's got. And I was like, what's his job? Oh, yeah, so, yeah.
Basically, like,
we heard Charles Peterson was making a record, so he thought, oh, we'll film that. I mean, that's all right, isn't it? I can handle that.
It's not bad, is it?
It's all right. I mean,
to be able to go to Brazil twice, wants to do something about football, and then, should we go back to do something about music with Charles Peterson? Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's a meeting you want to accidentally end up in and accidentally get commissioned at. We don't do badly for trips, do we, really, working
no.
at Monocle? But that's.
No, we certainly can't.
Frankly, a joke. so we should thank yes. all our guests, and Zelda de la Grange as well, talking about Nelson Mandela.
Exactly.
That was an interesting chat. We should thank all our guests. We should thank our friends behind the glass, Claire Urban and Thomas Lewis produced the show. And we'll be here again same time next week. You're looking at me, Steve, as I've forgotten to say something.
No, I think I don't know whether I'll be here next week.
I'm gonna be here next week.
Oh really?
No.
Okay.
Anyway, someone will
the
be
listener
here.
Will be.
The listener.
And they'll be
we just hope they brought a friend.
No, I don't want to sort of, you know, give you the impression that you're listening there, or like with lots and lots of people. It's a personal experience.
It is, it's 1-to-1, isn't it?
There we are, 1-to-1.
1-to-1.
Or 2-to-1, as it were. 2 of us to 1. Anyway, my point is, probably Andrew Tuck, probably Tom Edwards.
Probably. That's what I'm betting on.
Yeah.
So for the time being, it just remains for me, Robert Bound.
And me, Steve Bloomfield.
To say thanks for tuning in.